Hello and welcome. You're listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. Hello and welcome to episode 173 of Writers Aloud. In this episode, the first of a two-part interview, novelist Conan Jones speaks with James McConaughey about writing as a kind of imaginative remembering, the act of taking a novel from 90 to 30,000 words in a single cut, and why it's good to have more abandoned books in drawers than published ones on the shelf.
I'm sitting with Conan Jones in the cottage he renovated next to his family home in what feels like the wild west of Wales on a very windy day. Conan, you've said that when you think of a story, when you write a story, you do the work in your head, then write like I'm remembering. I'm very interested in that word, like I'm remembering. Is there a difference between writing from memory and writing from imagination?
I think, for me, because the drive is so visual, that the pictures have to be there before I go about the business of finding the words to put those pictures down on paper with. And the process of imagination, perhaps, creates those pictures before the act of writing. I'm not taken up during the act of writing by imagination as such. I am writing down what I have already imagined.
And is what you've imagined itself drawn heavily from memory?
I think that memory is a fascinating thing in that it also behaves as a filter. It can colour an experience. It can, in some ways, fictionalise and shape what has happened. Those are two real memories. I think a similar thing happens to imagined pieces that you are then trying to remember. So that recall, that process of memory, has an effect on the shaping of the story itself. There's also a survival of the fittest mechanism whereby when you're holding something in your head, a story in your head, the weaker elements of it perhaps fall away because you just don't remember them. They don't fight for place strongly enough. At the point of writing, you decide which elements of that whole picture you've created to put down to get it across in the strongest way.
You mentioned the point at which the story is ready to be put down. How long is that wait for you?
Let's take a working example, Cove. Cove was published in November 16. I began the writing of that in 2014, from what I thought was a relatively fresh idea. There had been a few months before that of doing research, building the story, gathering the details I needed. Looking back at notebooks, there's a note from 2008 which says, "Man is pulled out to sea by fish." Now, clearly someone's already written a story like that, so I abandoned that. There's a note from 2011, and I found this note because I was out in a kayak, and I found a bee in the water, a bumblebee in the water, and picked it out and put it on the deck of the kayak, and it dried in the sun, and it sort of stayed with me all the way back to shore, and it dried off and flew away. And I thought, what if I'd been stung? What if I had a bad reaction to that sting? And then immediately thought, I've had this before, I've thought of this, and looked into my notebooks. And in the notebooks of 2011, there's a note saying, "Man stung on kayak, weaverfish, wasp, what if he has anaphylaxis?" So that process that went into Cove took years, really, of feeding in real experiences I'd had, the stuff that, during the first drafts, didn't make it into the book. So that question, when is the point, and how long does it take before writing, I can say years. I think it's something that you can chase faster, harder, pin down, but actually it's only at a point that it is ready that it's truly time to write it.
It sounds, when you say chase it harder, faster, as if, maybe I'm reading something into the way you said that, as if doing that could be counterproductive.
I think it can be, and I know that from making that mistake. With Cove, there were deadlines. It was a two-book deal with The Dig, and there was a deadline for the next book, which was Cove, and I had to hit the 30,000-word mark. I didn't have enough time to really see it before I started writing it. I was writing it at the cliff face, if you like, hacking it out, and it was a nightmare for me, and it wasn't quite right. Granter were very much behind it. They liked it. They knew it wasn't right. Encouraged me to continue with it, but it just, for me, got worse and worse because I was trying to wrestle with it. And eventually I said to Granter, listen, I'm parking this. We need to just leave it. And I'll come back to it, or I might not. But it's not the right book. And they were brilliantly supportive on that. I think they were slightly perturbed. But what I did was having created those pictures, if you like, which usually happens inside my head, I'd figured everything out on the page. I then walked away, internalized all of that, and there was a point months later when what was left and what felt right was ready to write down, and I did it. And it was an amazing experience. It was such a quick, clean piece of writing, and most bizarrely, so much of the language, even word by word, is almost identical to some of the first draft stuff. The only problem with the process was it was 11,500 words when I finished it. But that was it. I was trying to make it a bigger novel. But it needed that time to not be chased, if you like, chased away.
It's interesting you mention it, the size of the novel. One of the striking things about your work is that of the five novels, two at least are very short. Is this, do you set out to write a novel of a certain size, or does the form come after the story, the images you've mentioned?
I think there's a number of things which led to my favouring the short novel as the form. Firstly, and it's the reason I write full stop, is a love of reading, but I really, really love the short novel form when I'm reading them. Secondly, I was working, and because of the process I work best at when I write is intense and it's complete and I can't do anything else while I'm doing it. In general, the work I was doing allowed me sort of January, February, March without much call. So that was when I kind of felt I had to write my book. So I always thought, well, I've got to start and finish something within that time. Also, the story ideas. Story is God, and it will determine the length that it should be. And if you try to artificially exaggerate things and add meat to it, it won't work. Again, coming back to Cove, for example, the reason it wouldn't work as a 30,000-word novel was because it wanted to be an 11,500-word novel, and it is a novel, as far as I'm concerned. The Dig, because of pressure to write a longer book, what bizarrely was often referred to as a real book, I thought I'd play a dupe and write two stories that interconnected. I actually spent about 3 years on a book called Traces of People. The second part of that book was the story of a farmer and a badger baiter, and a third character explained by the first book, if you like, and it was a 90,000-word book. And I'd done research in the libraries and museums, a lot of work. And when I read it back, having completed it, I realised that the real story was the story of the badger baiter and the farmer, and I cut 60,000 words out in a oneer.
And that cut, does it feel like a tragic loss and waste of all that energy and commitment to the other story?
No, because the endeavour is the writing. For me, it's the writing itself. And when I first started, the rule I set myself was to write as strongly as I could, and that everything else would be a side effect. And if the side effect is that book stays in a drawer, so be it. If it wins prizes, so be it. But it's about the act of writing, and you're always learning. And you gain a huge amount every time you do something, even if it fails. I truly think that writers should have more books in drawers than they do published on the shelf. And the danger is, when you commit to writing something, that you can't see the wood from the trees at a certain point. You can't see that perhaps it doesn't work, or that you're not ready to write that, or that it just shouldn't be written anyway. And you then are pushing for this is the book. I have to make this book. This is my book. This is my next book. Sometimes you just need to go, it was an exercise. What happened with that 60,000-word story, which fascinates me, is people that have read The Dig, a number of them, when I talk to reading groups or work with students, talk about this shard of metal that's in the ground. And lots of people say, well, that, what is that? There's something about that. There's a sort of totemic, you know, it's got something.
Yes.
I said, yes, it's got a 60,000-word story as to how it came to be in the ground behind it. So that 60,000 words is not gone. It is there. It's bedded in there. And it's tangible to the reader. Those things, I think, how you thicken a narrative, the resonances, the how you imbue, infuse all those things that need to hang into that narrative without having an overt presence, sometimes only happen because you've written them in there some way or another. Cove was 30,000 words. It's right back. It's really pared back. But the complexity is packaged in there because in many cases it was written in there at one point. You know, whether it's Odissean references or biblical stuff or just simple science, it's all gone in there and come back out. But what happens, I think, is a residue is left.
The other thing that's striking, looking across your oeuvre, is formally, they don't look, some of them, like conventional novels. I mean, Cove, in particular, is set on the page. It could almost be a volume of poetry. Is that deliberate?
I think the visuals of how text is on the page is vital too. I was sent a photograph from a friend who'd gone into a bookshop in Manchester and looked for Cove, and it came out and couldn't find it, and asked at the counter and said, yeah, I'm sure it's here, it came in. And they put it in the poetry section. They'd obviously seen the flaps, flicked through and went, right, poetry, in it went. The word deliberate's an interesting one for me because I would suggest it's instinctive rather than deliberate. But it is absolutely conscious. It is a choice. It is not a mechanism to make the book look longer. It is not an affectation.
There's a lot of white space, if I can explain.
There has to be. It's about white space. And it's about silence. It's about emptiness. It's about how weighty those emptinesses are. It's about the quantity of possibilities in those silences and spaces.
Another formal or stylistic experimentation appears in The Dig. Well, it's conspicuous that there are no speech marks. Can you describe how that came about?
The Dig was a fascinating book to be working on from the very word go in, as I've explained, being at one point a 90,000-word novel and then suddenly a 30,000-word novel. At that point, I'd spoken to the publishers that I had at the time about it and they seemed fired up. But when I delivered what I felt was the final thing, that 30,000-word story of a badger baiter and a farmer, they had a bit of a whitey. They thought, well, hang on, where's the Italian? Where's the second one? Where's the love story? That's what we want. And said, no, look, nobody wants to publish this. We don't want to publish this. Which is a huge blow, it's a moment when you question your confidence, you question what you've done, your decision. But the same week, Granta Magazine were in touch, and they'd heard about my writing and asked, do you have something perhaps that you could send in? This was a Wednesday, I think, and they said, we need it lunchtime Friday, because we've only just heard about you. And I'd torn The Dig apart, if you like, to see what was wrong with it. It'd just been rejected, and thought, well, maybe this bit in the middle doesn't quite work. But it existed as a 5,000-word set piece. So I sent that in to Granta Magazine, and John Freeman reacted incredibly to it, said, this is great, it's good, we're using it. And in his edit, he said, I suggest we drop the speech marks to create more proximity, to make more physical proximity.
So proximity of who to who?
I guess reader to character. Uh-huh. Rather than that artifice, that more obvious, now he's speaking, now he's acting, now he's speaking, now he's acting. He didn't explain it per se, but I, again, using this word instinct, instinctively understood what he meant. Then picking that up gave me the confidence that actually I did the right thing with the whole book. So I just stuck it back together again. And because it was published in the magazine, albeit with a, this is a part of a novel, the phone started ringing and publishers were saying, well, can we see this novel? It gave me the confidence, if you like, to not stick to form. And I think that confidence from The Dig, when it came to trying to get Cove right, because it wasn't right, as I've said, for a long time, it was, no, just go with your gut. You don't need to do it this way. You can shift tense. You can shift from we to he to I to... You can do all of these things. The reader will go with it, and you will create different proximities and different relationships in doing so.
Your trust in the reader is striking. It seems to me that many publishers do not trust the reader in quite the same way, or many publishers in this country at least. Have you found that? Is there pressure to, well, to write a real novel, to write a conventional piece of narrative?
There is. There certainly was. I think there's less now. Well, publishers are seeming to give things more of a chance. But these are maybe books which are happening because a precedent has been set. That's the problem. Publishing is venture capitalism, and you've got to have brave people to back brave things.
You've talked about things being sparse, about stripping away, about reducing 90,000 words to 30,000 words. There seems to be a very strong ambition and aspiration to be unwasteful.
It's something perhaps driven by a real desire to try not to patronise readers or to revel in yourself as the writer. You know, oh, well, I better say that again a different way, and I better give them all the details, and I better, you know, then tell them what someone actually feels like when they're frightened and how their eyes widen and their palms sweat and their heart beats. I better give them all of that because I'm building a whole world. I have to build a big picture. I have to give all the readers these emotions. No, just frighten them. What's interesting to me in stripping things out is it's not about a tidiness. It probably is about unwastefulness, but it's more about creating space for the reader. Yet again, it's about not patronising them. Everything I found on the beach, I spoke to some school kids who were looking at it, and one of them said, oh, I love your description of the beach. It's, you know, it's really alive. And I said, OK, go and find the description of the beach. And they couldn't find it, because there isn't a description of the beach. It's just a description of the stones clacking or moon catching a line of quartz. He built the picture. It's his picture. And that, for me, is the endeavour, rather than a kind of tidiness or an efficiency.
There's an aspect of your work, what you might call the nature writing aspect. I wondered if it was true that you were, in some sense, an environmental writer. And I mean that in the broadest sense, but as well in the more narrow sense of interested in questions of what is sustainable, what can be preserved, what is at risk from modernity. Is that something you perceive in your own work?
I live here, so those questions are actually reality. They are very real. They're not academic questions. They're not questions discussed in a Sunday newspaper. And they're not new questions for me either. They've been given different titles now. They've been given various sound bites. And for me, growing up in this environment, all of my life pretty much, and having a very close relationship with the landscape around me, I find it quite strange that it's now become a thing with a title. Rural writing, landscape writing, nature writing. I mean, none of these are things which I really understand. You know, was Steinbeck a nature writer then? But because I'm writing about authentic things, or rather, I am writing as authentically as I can about this area, this place, and this place is infused with the questions of balance, the questions of sustainability, the questions of how you continue on small-scale farming in the face of the economic changes we've gone through, when everything essentially has got to submit to the feeding of cities. And all of those little questions, like I said, these are not political issues for people, these are life issues, these are real. And it's always slightly odd when you're then asked, well, what are your real thoughts on this? How do you align yourself with this? How do you say, well, this is just natural. Things have to happen here. So again, I think in some respects, a lot of that is the city peering out of its window at the countryside around it and going, ooh, you know, you're not living in it. So it's a different kind of relationship.
The Dig, it strikes me, one of the many ways it could be read, is as, I wouldn't go as far as allegory, but tending that way, that you have one character who grows from the landscape, tends it, cares for it, curates it, and another character who abuses and exploits it. The difference seems so stark that I can't help but feel that you must have had that almost political purpose in mind.
I'm not sure it was a political purpose more than the attempt to show the different thing the land is to different people. Pretty much all the novels, all the stories are driven by a central allegory, if you like. And with The Dig, what I wanted to talk about was the way we create a safe space for ourselves and how something can dig into that space. In The Dig, it comes in the form of this badger bait who you know, digs into the badger set. And once you've got that, the badger set suddenly providing this great central solid allegory in the middle of it, it spins out from there. Badgers, it is black and white, but there's a lot of grey. And so the guy that's, you know, the guy that's using and abusing the landscape, if you like, is also innately linked with it. And the political thing is quite interesting because, you know, that 90,000 word book, I wrote the farmer badger baiter story first, long before the badger cull really became something. And they scheduled the badger cull a year earlier in Wales than in England and actually abandoned it. It never happened. But was obviously very political when it came to the fore. And that, just by chance, really coincided with The Dig being picked up and published. So there's obviously, that looks like it's more deliberate than it is, the political element. But in the research I did into that part of the story, the things you find out, the not just political, but the social aspect of badger baiting, of dog fighting, you have to resist putting your opinions in there of these things. These are not mouthpieces for my political views on badger culls, bovine TB, dog breeding for fights. The reader, again, has to make those decisions, and I'm just trying to put it down as it is, fairly. I try to be fair to those violent characters as much as I try to be fair to the others. And
that comes across. There's a surprising sympathy for all that the badger baiter is a terrifying, really terrifying character. There is a strange sympathy.
But it's his context and how he is, you know. I think we all, very few people are not trying to do the best they can with the weaponry they have. And depending on that weaponry, that's all you've got to go into any given situation.
You mentioned research on the badger baiting. How far, how deep did you go into that world?
So the badger stuff was actually on two levels. One was the science and this idea of the, you know, the cull, that all sort of came in. And one thing that struck me was how lunatic the science was. It just doesn't stack, that they're really causing the problem. Maybe it stacks more that they're causing problems where people want to rebuild roads and there's a Badger Protection Act or, you know, an estate of houses, but they can't put it on that land because of an ancient set. And so there's all these sort of slightly suspicious side issues. Again, there's no room for that in the book. The culture of badger baiting, badger digging, was one that I really needed to know did happen. There's a lot of books about the act of it, how to do it. And actually still people I talk to, they're still alive, who used to go badger digging as a village after church on Sunday. And it was a great sport. And they sort of took picnics and they dug a badger out. Then they put it in a sack and the badger was taken away. So there's the act of badger digging. There's also the act of badger baiting, which is the next step. Now, I've seen dead badgers on the road all of my life. The number of them go up in the holidays, particularly around Easter, when people sort of come into the area. Oh, well, there's more cars on the road. Yeah, but there's also more skinheads with angry-looking dogs walking around as well in combat gear. So I've always had this suspicion, well, hang on, I've lived here all of my life, never come close to hitting a badger. Yes, they have their runs. You can basically stand next to them and they'll run past you if you're on one of those runs. But, you know, when they're suddenly on random pieces of the road, it does provoke a question. So I went into that. I talked to the Badger Trust, the David Badger Trust, who kind of furnished me with visual material that you don't want to see more than once, of badgers that had been baited, of sets that had been dug up. In terms of the people doing this, what I discovered going on some dog breeding forums was there's sort of key words that are codes, if you like. And so I created personalities, and after a certain amount of time, you get in with the in crowd, and they maybe will send you a link to somewhere which flashes up, not for very long, for a few hours of an afternoon really, where they've uploaded photos of their dog. And the stuff up there is extraordinary. Dogs with these sort of flaps of neck hanging off, and look at my champion, nothing a good stitching up won't sort out, you know, he's a winner. All these sort of bizarre subculture violence there. I didn't do that for very long, but I needed to know it was real, if that made sense.
The reader's sense of needing to know it's real. Do you think that your presence here in this landscape, the fact that you offered to set the nets to cook me fish after this interview, do you think it's a necessary part of our trust in you as a writer, that you have lived it, you do, are born from this soil?
I suppose that comes in, that comes through, I hope, in the writing, and it comes through in the choice of what I write about. But I also think that perhaps writers go about the business of attempting to provoke trust by making a visit to a certain place, or, you know, spending 2 weeks doing a certain thing. You know, we're innately curious creatures, writers. And much as I'm curious about the wider world too, what feels right to me is to write the stories that are from here. And in that respect, I don't necessarily see that as a commodity. I don't see myself as something that has to go out and earn the reader's trust. The books do, and the books will only do that if the writing's strong enough, and the writing will only be strong enough if I practice hard enough and interrogate that writing hard enough and write the right stories.
That was Conan Jones in conversation with James McConachie. You can find out more about Conan on his website at www.conanjones.com. That's Conan, spelt C-Y-N-A-N. And that concludes episode 173, which was recorded by James McConachie and produced by Conan McPhee. Coming up in episode 174, we have the second installment of our Breakpoint series. Ruth Thomas explains how the publishing industry went cool on her genre, and how a 60p discovery at a charity book fair helped her regain her mission and extend her range. Then Mimi Thebo considers the myriad ways writers can fail and describes how she came back from failure, and before that, from something even more serious. We hope you'll join us. You've been listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. To subscribe to podcasts and to find out more about the work of the RLF, please visit our website at www.rlf.org.uk. Thanks for listening.